It is a desolate landscape. The windswept plain, a strange, lifeless reflection of what it once was. Now, it is a tomb. Beneath the grasses lie a litany of bones. Ribs and skulls, tusks and femurs, the scattered remains of long-vanished animals. For thousands of years, they accumulated in layers beneath the feet of the few who remained, a silent record of extinction. Once, this place was alive. Herds of mammoths trampled these grasslands. Saber-toothed cats stalked sloths the size of cars. Beavers bigger than black bears gnawed at riverside trees, while armored glyptodonts, like huge armadillos, lumbered through the underbrush. Ecosystems thrived. And then, quite suddenly in terms of evolutionary history, they were all gone. In a relatively short time, these great beasts disappeared. But what disaster befell this land? What destroyed the life that once thrived here? What could command such death and devastation across years, across seasons? Humans. We arrived in the Americas late and made a devastating entrance. We hunted with an efficiency that no North American animal had evolved to escape. Mammoths, mastodons, and giant ground sloths had no ingrained fear of these strange, hairless creatures with sharp sticks. Within a few millennia of humanity's arrival, over 70% of North America's large mammals had vanished. In Australia, a similar story. The extinction of approximately 85% of the continent's megafauna. Scientists still debate the influence of climatic factors happening alongside these human hunts, although with later megafauna extinctions in Madagascar and New Zealand, the verdict is clear. It was us. As we spread into every corner of the globe, we were not just another species in the food web, we were decimating it. But what was it that made our species the kind of predator that could hunt creatures to extinction? Hundreds of thousands of years before the invention of projectile bows and stone-tipped weapons, how did we manage to hunt and kill at all? Humans have no sharp teeth and claws, so how did we evolve to become such deadly, collaborative killers? And what did this bloodthirsty ability do to us? How did killing mold our species? The El Cidrón Neanderthal population lived isolated in the hills of northern Spain. Their fossilized bones show a range of congenital anomalies consistent with a lack of genetic diversity. And a tooth from around the same period in a cave in southern France revealed another Neanderthal population that remarkably had been genetically isolated for over 50,000 years. And isolation was a hallmark of the last days of the Neanderthals, whereas today's world is vastly more connected. It is Sunday morning in the suburbs of 1950s America. House after house after house in perfect alignment. White fences, green lawns, a carefully managed sense of calm. But through the streets of readying churchgoers comes a paper boy carrying a publication that will shock breakfast tables across America. Volume 1, Issue 4, of the International Anthropological and Linguistic Review. The blood-bespattered, slaughter-gutted archives of human history, from the earliest Egyptian and Sumerian records to the most recent atrocities of the Second World War, accord with early universal cannibalism, with animal and human sacrificial practices. On this thesis, man's predecessors differed from living apes in being confirmed killers, carnivorous creatures that seized living quarries by violence, battered them to death, tore apart their broken bodies, dismembered them limb from limb, slaking their ravenous thirst with the hot blood of victims, and greedily devouring living, writhing flesh. This was The Predatory Transition from Ape to Man, published in 1953 by Raymond Dart, an archaeologist and anthropologist who would seek to define man by his most violent traits. He asked the reader whether humans are defined by violence, separated from other apes not because of our superior intellect, but our superior ability to kill. And indeed, Raymond Dart was not the first or last to question our evolutionary relationship with hunting and killing. Concepts such as man the hunter and the killer ape hypothesis were a line of thinking that had begun a century before. Oxford, 1860. A packed hall at the University Museum quietens for the start of one of the most talked about debates of the century. Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, commanding, confident, takes to the stage and begins a thorough takedown of Darwin's theory of evolution. He dismisses the laughable idea of common ancestry with apes as both unproven and demeaning. And finally, he asks his opposite, Darwin's bulldog, Thomas Huxley, if his ape lineage could be traced through his grandfather or grandmother. Huxley, however, remains cool. He smiles a wry smile and replies that he would rather be descended from an ape than from a man who used his intellect to mock scientific endeavor. This was a time when Darwin's theories were being discussed in all of educated society. In The Descent of Man, Darwin had argued that traits like bravery, group loyalty, and even morality had evolutionary roots. That these things that supposedly raised us above animals were not ours by ordained right, but existed as a result of slow and gradual changes that all offered some benefit. And Darwin saw hunting as one of these traits that separated us from other apes. Bipedalism and our upright posture, he believed, freed the hands to wield tools and weapons, and these weapons in turn helped us become dominant over other animals. With mankind, he wrote, the arms and teeth are greatly reduced, but the hands are admirably adapted for many purposes and are capable of acting in obedience to the will. And so as the decades passed, little evidence arose to challenge or indeed build upon the idea that hands and minds produced weapons that led to the mastery of the animal kingdom. Even religious minds were being convinced by Darwin's ideas and hypothesizing about hunting in prehistory. A far cry from Bishop Samuel Wilberforce, French Catholic priest Henri Breuer was one of the pioneers of Paleolithic anthropology. Breuer began his work in the early 1900s and spent many years crawling through dusty caves, armed with candlelight and gas lamps, meticulously copying down sketches and making etches of Ice Age cave art in France and Spain. He proposed that these images of animals, from between 10 to 15,000 years ago, often surrounded by stick figure hunters or shown in motion, were not merely decorative. Instead, he believed that they were part of a ritualistic hunting magic. According to Breuer, early humans believed that depicting animals being successfully hunted in art could make it so in real life, a sort of prehistoric manifestation. But Breuer's theory of sympathetic magic wasn't based on anything other than what he saw before him on the cave walls. And while his ideas encouraged other anthropologists to consider ancient humans as being capable of complex belief systems, his views are now considered too simplistic. Indeed, we now think prehistoric humans could have been capable of decoration, art for art's sake. And even if Breuer's claim had been accepted, his evidence was from a period very close to the present in evolutionary terms. As we moved through the early years of the 20th century, no one had yet dug further into our deeper evolutionary past. Did our adaptation to hunting begin with the stone weapons that Darwin and his contemporaries spoke of? Or did our bodies and minds have a deeper, longer-held connection to hunting and killing? And it is here where Raymond Dart enters the story. From the 1920s to the 1950s, Dart, who had discovered the potential human ancestor, Australopithecus africanus, argued that early hominins were not peaceful gatherers, but aggressive hunters who rose to dominance through bloodshed. Man's predecessors, he wrote, differed from living apes in being confirmed killers. Dart was an eccentric figure. Indeed, he cleaned up his most famous find, the skull of the tongue child, with his wife's knitting needle. But he was also a renowned anthropologist who challenged orthodoxy. He proposed that early hominins were innately violent, and even cannibalistic. This aggression, he believed, drove human evolution. By killing animals, humans ate better and became stronger and smarter. By killing each other, the strongest individuals could outcompete the weakest. He went on to establish osteodontocratic theory, proposing that Australopithecus used bones, teeth, and horns as tools and weapons, copying the way that animals use them in situ. Dart described our ape ancestors as mighty hunters, who brought back these bone weapons from the carcasses of their kills. The primary evidence for this were a series of broken and fractured skulls, belonging to both Australopithecus and baboons. The baboons were posited to be the hunted prey of our not-yet-human ancestors, and the damaged Australopith skulls the result of murderous infighting, driven by the same aggression that enabled our rise from hunted to hunter. He even took this idea of deadly hominins further, and with much backlash from contemporaries, when he suggested a culture built around death. He asked the world to see our ancestors as fearsome, crazed creatures, willing to use any weapon to kill any foe in the pursuit of dominance. Despite other scientists' reservations about Dart's theories of man as the descendants of killer apes, the essence of his ideas were not entirely dismissed or cast aside. And indeed, they would continue to rise in prominence with an unlikely new champion, a playwright. Robert Ardrey had written plays for Broadway stages and scripts for Hollywood movies, but he was also a science writer who was asked to investigate Dart's work. He went on to write a series of best-selling books that repackaged Dart's research and ideas into a gripping, controversial story that captivated readers still living in the aftermath of a world war and the emergence of nuclear weapons. But despite its popularity and its ability to seemingly explain an ever-dangerous 20th century, the killer ape hypothesis put forward by both Dart and Ardrey was wrong. The theory hung upon the broken skull fossils, but it turns out our ancestors weren't the aggressors here. Archaeologist John Langdon noted that one of Dart's mistakes was to discount the damage that the soil itself could do to an Australopith skull that was not filled with sediment. But what about the more severe damage? Surely that was the work of a killer? Maybe not. Archaeologist Sherwood Washburn and others found the real hunters here to be ancient relatives of hyenas. The killer ape, Australopithecus, was not the hunter, but the hunted. And so, where does this leave the search for the origins of hunting? If, as it turns out, we are descended from killer apes, how did we come to be hunters? In the bleak, frozen expanse of northern Alaska, an archaeologist from Virginia sets up camp. But he's not there to dig up bones or analyze grave sites. Lewis Binford is there to study the living, more specifically, the Nunimut Inupiat, a semi-nomadic, caribou-hunting people. He has embedded himself within the group, enduring the sub-zero temperatures of their homeland. He has shared their tents and meals, and followed the rhythms of their seasonal hunts. He has become accustomed to their customs. This is what he calls living archaeology. And using what he found, several years later, Lewis Binford would challenge everything we thought we knew about hunting and early humans. Two famous archaeologists of the time, Louis and Mary Leakey, had spent the 1960s and 70s studying fossils from Olduvai Gorge, the cradle of humankind in Tanzania, and had found evidence for organized hunting, meat sharing, and early social structures. This had all supported the man the hunter narrative, that hunting was central to human evolution and development, as these earliest tools, now known as the Oldowan industry, were dated to almost 2 million years ago and attributed to Homo habilis, the earliest member of our genus. But Lewis Binford didn't buy into the hunting conclusion because of what he had seen in nomadic tribes in Alaska. There, he had watched closely as carcasses were butchered, tools used and discarded, and the bones sorted, cracked, or left behind. He noted what his hosts carried back to their camp and what was left behind for scavengers. He spoke to them about their rituals, their routines. He wrote down how their activities shifted over time. And he saw, through the patterns of the Nunimut Inupiat, that the traces of life that archaeologists often interpreted as structured activity or organized space could just as easily be explained by mundane routines, interrupted tasks, and natural decay. This was a brand new approach that connected observable human behavior with the archaeological record. By observing modern hunter-gatherers, archaeologists could apply what they had learned to more accurately interpret their findings. Binford noted that many of the bones at Olduvai bore carnivore tooth marks before cut marks, suggesting that hominins arrived late to carcasses that were already part devoured by big-toothed beasts, and scavenged leftovers rather than hunting down kills themselves. He also questioned the assumption that the site was a home base to which hunters would drag their defeated prey. He argued that the site's layout did not support extended habitation or coordinated group behavior, based on his knowledge of modern hunter-gatherer behaviors. This was yet another major challenge to the man-the-hunter line of thinking that had lingered on since the time of Darwin. And perhaps it also bruised our human egos a little. We had become accustomed to seeing our ancestors as brutes, fighting and conquering their way up the food chain. Could Binford truly be right? Was the reality that we spent far more time as mere scavengers, picking at the kills of other, stronger creatures? When we think of carcasses, we think of bare bones, strips of flesh hanging limp and thin. Could such slim pickings really be what our ancestors survived on? This is where Robert Blumenschein enters the story. He was interested in Binford's theory, and he wanted to put it to the test. He wondered whether the homeland of humanity, the plains of Africa, was fruitful enough in its dead creatures to feed our ancestors in this way. Beginning in the 1980s, Blumenschein combined field observation with experimental archaeology. Out in the heat of the Serengeti, he watched how scavengers, like hyenas, lions, jackals, and vultures, descended on carcasses in the wild and saw how long different parts of abandoned bodies remained accessible and, importantly, edible. And what he found only added fuel to Binford's earlier fire. Often, meat and marrow-rich bones specifically were left intact for hours, even days, on the plains. More than enough time then for leftovers to be utilized by an opportunistic, big-brained Homo habilis with a sharp-edged rock, the earliest stone tools found at Olduvai. Blumenschein showed definitively that our ancestors' environment could be a rich table for a scavenger. And the tools found at Olduvai also hinted at our distant ancestors' methods of food acquisition and their changing relationships with meat, and eventually, the hunt itself. The so-called Oldowan toolkit, primarily made by Homo habilis, dates from around 2.6 to 1.5 million years ago, and is the first confirmed evidence of human-made tools yet found. Uncovered in Gona, Ethiopia, and Olduvai Gorge, these are relatively simple, unmodified flakes created by striking one stone against another to produce a sharp edge. However, though we will likely never know for sure, these were likely not used for hunting. Their size and shape suggests instead a multi-utility, domestic tool, used for bashing nuts, hacking at branches, and for butchering what was already dead, slicing meat, scraping hides, and cracking bones to extract marrow. These kinds of tools became more sophisticated some 1.75 million years ago, when the so-called Acheulean industry emerged. This is a term used for large cutting tools, like hand axes, associated with early Homo erectus, and which could do more heavy work than the older one flakes. Their regular and symmetrical shape suggests the use of a mental template and forward planning, and likely required refined motor control in fingers and hands. These tools might have allowed for a wider range of tasks, butchery, but also possibly digging and hammering, but still nothing yet resembling a spear or an axe head. And so the question remains, when did we start hunting? To begin to unravel this, we must journey back around 200,000 years to Schöningen in what is modern-day Germany. A group of humans are stalking a horse. They're quiet through the woodland, their unshod feet soft on the leafy ground. The horse stops every now and again, raises its head, flicks its ears, but it hears nothing and continues to graze. They reach a stream. The horse bends its head to drink. Two of the humans sneak up, closer and closer. They are mere feet from the horse. Suddenly, as one, they launch forward and thrust wooden spears towards the beast. The horse bolts, but they watch as bright blood spurts onto the green forest floor. The horse may be gone from sight, but it is too late. The rough-edged points have found their way into its hide. All that is needed now is to follow the path of blood. And hundreds of thousands of years later, this site in Germany provides the oldest, clear-cut, documented record of a human species killing a large animal via close encounter hunting. These carefully balanced spears, potentially used for throwing, but more likely thrusting, were found alongside butchered horse remains, and they give us the full picture of not only butchery, but the hunt itself. Unfortunately, looking for weapons any deeper into our evolutionary history is a particularly tricky task. The oldest known wooden weapon is the Clacton spear, discovered in Clacton-on-Sea in England. It's estimated to be around 420,000 years old, and like the spears from Schöningen, it was preserved in waterlogged, oxygen-poor clay. Saturated and sealed from the air, the microbes that normally digest wood were kept away. Indeed, these rare conditions explain why the archaeological record so severely underrepresents wooden technology. It wasn't that our ancestors didn't use wood to make rudimentary weapons. Given that chimpanzees use wooden tools, they almost certainly did. But only lakeside mud, peat bogs, frozen soils, or volcanic ash offer the conditions needed to preserve it. And so Schöningen gives us the full hunt, and Clacton just the weaponry itself, but we can actually trace ancient wooden weapons even further back than the weapons themselves. In Boxgrove, England, the shoulder blade of a horse was discovered, dating back around 500,000 years. The Boxgrove site holds numerous remains of horses, deer, and rhinoceros bearing cut marks consistent with butchery, but this shoulder blade was different. It was punctured, bearing a near circular hole that shows us it was hunted by a spear before being butchered. And it doesn't stop with wooden weapons. Something even more miraculous has been found in the ancient sinkholes of South Africa. The Kathu Pan site is a number of sinkhole exposures northwest of the mining town of Kathu in the Northern Cape province of South Africa. Excavated by Peter Beaumont in the late 70s and early 80s, the finds include a hoard of stone points, ranging from 4 centimeters up to 9 centimeters in length. Subsequent study of these has revealed damage to the points consistent with hafting, fixing these points to wooden shafts to allow hominins to hunt not just with sharpened wood, but with fully fledged spears. Hafting requires the combination of multiple materials, techniques, and cooperation. and hafted weapons would mark a significant juncture in the advancement of hunting techniques and capabilities. And so the question is, what was the date of this complex, advanced weaponry? Also, roughly 500,000 years ago. And so, looking at the fossil record, we have two ends of the puzzle. 500,000 years ago, our ancestors were capable of hunting large animals with weapons. And 2,000,000 years ago, the tools we find in the earth paint a picture of opportunistic butchers scavenging their meals from already dead beasts. What happened in between? Tools for butchering meat continue throughout the gap, but how did those animals die? Was our genus, Homo, scavengers for 3/4 of their existence, with hunting being only a more recent chapter? Or can we push back deeper, back further than 500,000 years, and find some earlier evidence of our ability to hunt? And indeed, if we were hunting and killing before the advent of stone-tipped weaponry, how did we do it? The roar of the crowd swells as the gates creak open. A gladiator stands in the pit, his armor glinting in the sun. Across the arena, a gate crashes open and out springs a beast. Huge shoulders, a mane all dusty and ragged, claws the length of daggers, its breath steaming in the cold Roman morning. A lion. The man takes position, holds out his spear, but the lion doesn't hesitate and runs at the gladiator. He's shunted sideways, his shield knocked away, his spear sent spinning into the far-off wall. He turns. The lion readies itself once more. The gladiator raises his fists. But really, what hope is there? Perhaps he whispers a prayer, or perhaps he simply gives himself up. He is a human stripped of all his power. No tools, no armor, just a man, the weakness of his flesh and bones. And indeed, what are humans without weapons, without tools? We are physically unimpressive compared to many other predators in the animal kingdom. Crocodiles can bite at over 3,000 psi, whereas ours barely reach 160. A 700-pound grizzly bear can sprint at 35 miles an hour, faster than any speed ever recorded by a human sprinter. A tiger's claw can easily cut into the flesh of their prey or rip straight through a human hand. And so, physically, what do we have? Before flint-topped spears, arrows, and daggers, humans had to rely on far less deadly weaponry. Simple wooden tools and simple wooden weapons. We can't definitively trace this further back than 500,000 years, but the fact that chimpanzees and other primates have been observed using sharpened sticks for digging, spearing insects, or as clubs, hints at a long-held capacity to use some simple forms of tools not that dissimilar from weapons. But even if we were to imagine our ancestors in possession of these 1,000,000 years or more in the past, this still leaves a species with relatively weak bodies, exposed on the plains of ancient Africa, holding sharpened sticks. How could they have been successful hunters? For decades, the search for the answer had focused on the objects we left behind. Splintered skulls, sharpened wood and stone, scavenged carcasses. But a new idea was about to emerge, one that shifted the focus from what we held in our hands to what we are. In 1991, a group of young physiologists watched a pig run on a treadmill, and it set them on the path to a revolutionary idea. David Carrier was the starting point. He first proposed that our physiology made us good at hunting. His colleagues, Dennis Bramble and Daniel Lieberman, became enamored with the idea, and their belief in Carrier's theory was confirmed for them while they watched the pigs run. They saw how the heads lurched and wobbled uncontrollably. They compared this to humans. When we run, our head stays remarkably steady. Steady enough to hold our sights on distant prey as our feet cover the ground. Think about the human head while running, Lieberman said in one interview. If you watch someone with a ponytail running, the ponytail bobs up and down. That's because of the pitching forces acting on the head. The head itself stays very stable. There are special mechanisms. The semicircular canals in human heads are greatly enlarged relative to apes, for instance, that give us a much greater ability to perceive and react to rapid accelerations of the head. These structures act like gyroscopes. They enable us to sense acceleration and counteract it, and keep our gaze level, even when our bodies bounce. Working together, these physiologists compared humans to four-legged mammals, and started to note key parts of our anatomy that made us specifically good at distance running. Humans, they argued, may have evolved not for strength or speed, but for relentless pursuit. Then there was our temperature control. Most mammals overheat rapidly when pushed to run at speeds in hot weather, but humans cool efficiently through sweating. Quadrupeds, four-legged beasts, pant to cool themselves, but because panting is incompatible with galloping, they can't run and keep cool at the same time. A big constraint when it comes to running for long periods of time, especially in hot conditions. If you force a mammal to gallop in the heat for 15 minutes, you ultimately force it to stop or die. And David Carrier came up with even more evidence. We have short toes that reduce impact and lower running energy costs. Our Achilles tendons act like springs, storing and releasing energy with each stride. Our large gluteus maximus muscles help stabilize our torsos. So we have upright bodies, steady heads, can sweat to keep ourselves cool, and our feet and ankles and knees move with economy, making the most of our energy and allowing us to keep going on and on and on. Taken together, these features, Carrier argued, create a slow, all-day runner who does not need to be fast, only unrelenting. Carrier, Lieberman, and Bramble's work found a receptive audience in the early 2000s. Around this time, Louis Liebenberg was documenting the hunting practices of the San people of Namibia. These hunters tracked and chased springbok for hours, relying on intimate knowledge of their environment. Lieberman read this work with interest and thought it aligned with his own research that seemed to suggest a deeply seated power to run in humans. And so he ultimately suggested that the features that Carrier had originally identified as making us so good at endurance running evolved many millennia ago, around 2 million years ago in fact. And further, that these features were so important to our survival that they became central to the evolution of our entire physiology. And of course, this date of 2 million years ago, if accurate, was important, because it coincided with when our Homo ancestors emerged and started to eat a meat-rich diet. It seemed to all come together. Persistence hunting, we ran our prey into the ground, like biological terminators that never stopped coming over the horizon. The theory was groundbreaking. It reinvigorated research into the biomechanics of running and thermoregulation. It received thousands of academic citations and ranks among the most influential studies on human physiology. And indeed, this narrative was not just captivating to scientists. The media caught on. The New York Times ran features. Journalist and runner Christopher McDougall wrote Born to Run, a bestseller that spent weeks on the New York Times list in 2009, selling over 1 million copies. Persistence hunting sounded right. If true, it would change how we viewed our ancestors, suggesting an earlier ability to coordinate complex hunting strategies, rather than using brute force, a long way from DART's bloodthirsty thugs. And so it's easy to see how the idea took hold, It was almost romantic. The dedicated hunter, working hard, never giving up, focused on the goal. Until, that is, someone came up with a sticking point. In the late 2000s, Kara Wall Scheffler, a biological anthropologist at Seattle Pacific University, along with other scientists, wanted to test some of the ideas around how humans regulate their temperature to see if they really fit the endurance running model. And what they found threatened the foundations of persistence hunting theory. While human runners are indeed efficient at cooling themselves, Wall Scheffler reported our cooling system is deeply reliant on a key element: water. If we lose too much of it, we die. And so if our ancestors were running for long distances, over hours, in the heat, they would be losing water through sweat. Lots of water. Under typical savanna temperatures of 30 to 35 degrees Celsius, a 70 kilogram human jogging at 8 to 10 kilometers per hour without water would reach dangerous levels of dehydration in just 3 to 5 hours. But what about the sand people and other real-life persistent hunters seen in the modern day? They hunted prey over much longer time periods. Well, they had modern adaptations. Bottles and stored water tanks around hunting grounds. Early humans most likely lacked such necessary equipment. Indeed, the first evidence for water-carrying technology, such as hide bladders or plant containers, don't appear in archaeology until tens of thousands of years after Homo erectus, who Carrier had proposed as the first persistent hunter. Although these materials are highly perishable, so it is difficult to say for sure, but it is also difficult to make a case for Homo erectus running for multiple hours without this kind of equipment. It was clear our ancestors simply couldn't run far and long without enough water. Was this the death knell of persistence hunting theory? In short, no. But it did need some revising. Like many evolutionary ideas, persistence hunting had seemed so intuitive, and the story just made sense. But the story was too neat. The reality, like humans themselves, is likely more messy. In the early 2000s, Henry Bunn and Travis Pickering studied some bones that weren't the age they should have been. Dated to between 1.8 to 2 million years ago, the bones were from ancient waterbuck, antelope, and wildebeest. Discovered by the Leakeys in Olduvai Gorge, Bunn and Pickering had reinvestigated the data. 200 bones bearing cut marks from stone tools, as well as signs of hammerstone blows used to break bones for marrow. They were working on the following premise. If early humans were using persistence hunting to acquire large prey, like buffalo or wildebeest, then the bones left behind should mostly be from the more vulnerable animals. Young calves and aging individuals who would have run slower, run out of energy faster. Indeed, Bunn had long been suspicious of persistence as a catch-all solution to the history of human hunting. Even if ancient humans had been able to run near indefinitely, would they have been able to track their fleeing prey as it escaped over the terrain, until it became exhausted enough to kill? The ages of the bones they studied did not do much for the persistence hunting camp. They found that most of the butchered bones came from prime-aged adults, animals at the peak of their strength, not animals likely to be run to exhaustion too easily. And as well as this, the age of the bones was also equally inconsistent with scavenging. And so, something else was happening. These animals died by another method. Behind a tumbled wall of rock, three figures crouch. Like us, but shorter and stockier, these are Homo erectus. In their hands are crude hand axes of rock, cracked and sharpened, but blunt by modern measure. They have waited here since dawn, eyes fixed on the narrow corridor of green below. On either side of this scrap of greenery rise low, rocky hills. They don't know the names of the rock types that lie beneath their feet, or know what nutrients make this patch of land so fertile, but they know animals come this way. Were early humans ambush predators? This is what Bunn and Pickering's study of the ancient bovine bones in Tanzania would conclude. And indeed, further study has painted a picture of ambushes just like the attack on Pelorhovis antiquus, happening many times in the scrublands of southern Kenya between 1.5 million years ago, the Middle Pleistocene. Although, without a fossil record of weaponry, how could we possibly know this? One 2015 study, led by geologist Simon Kubler, investigated this by looking at the land itself. The Ulugasailey region in southern Kenya is notable for a very high concentration of Acheulean hand axes, thought to have been used to butcher meat. And Kubler's team had sought to answer why there were so many in one place. They mapped ancient fault lines, sampled modern soils, interviewed Maasai farmers and trackers, and reconstructed how the land might have looked hundreds of thousands of years ago. And what they found was a kind of natural trap, a landscape where fault scarps and volcanic rock created forced paths. The land created fertile patches of soil, rich in calcium and phosphorus, that led to abundant foliage and drew grazing animals. Together, this specific geography created narrow, predictable corridors to enticing patches of ground. And so they speculated that early hominins, long before bows helped them hunt at range, may have used the Earth's architecture to corner their prey. Not scavenging leftover meat, but waiting where animals would be sure to pass. This is the behavior of a strategic thinker, a creature able to read the land and predict the future. Ambush hunting, then, requires enhanced brain power in a way that running doesn't. To achieve a successful ambush, a group of humans must understand the habits of prey, memorize terrain, account for wind and visibility, predict escape patterns, and above all, communicate. Whether through gestures, eye contact, or the very basic foundations of language, early humans would have to coordinate in real time. This kind of coordination requires mental models of others' intentions, understanding what others know or do not know, i.e., a theory of mind. And of course, it also demands planning of times, shared attention, and trust. Indeed, while a solitary runner may bring down a dying animal, it takes a group to coordinate to bait prey or drive it into a trap. Evolutionary biologists Leslie Aiello and Peter Wheeler offered a similar argument in their expensive tissue hypothesis. They argued that brains are high cost for our bodies, consuming about 20% of our resting metabolic energy. For early hominins to afford such an expense, they needed nutrient-dense fuel. And meat, especially animal fat, provided that. And they also likely wanted to conserve energy. For the problem is, persistence hunting is calorically expensive and not reliable. A hunter might run for hours and return empty-handed. Ambush hunting, on the other hand, requires some setup, but then it's simply a matter of sitting still and waiting. But that's not to say persistence hunting doesn't occur at all. Indeed, a 2024 study reported 400 cases of long-distance running used for hunting in modern-day tribes from over 200 globally distributed locations. So where does the truth lie? It now seems that a mixed strategy allowed our ancestors to survive. Embracing endurance, ambush, and scavenging allowed early human ancestors to exploit whatever opportunity the landscape presented. In this view, our evolutionary strength lies not in one single skill, but in our flexibility. And this flexibility and adaptability came from and enhanced our big brains. That cognitive adaptability is also visible in the history of our bones. Isotopic analysis is a scientific technique that measures the ratios of stable isotopes, different forms of elements like carbon, in bones. These ratios can reveal information about long-term diet, such as the proportion of meat versus plants. And this analysis on the bones of our ancestors show a dramatic dietary shift beginning around 2.5 million years ago. Early Homo species were eating meat at far higher rates than our primate cousins, chimpanzees or gorillas. We had switched to a meat-forward species despite limited weaponry and tools. As well as this, ancient DNA found on tools and butchered bones shows residues of large mammal tissues alongside plant starches, while genome studies show how human metabolism has adapted to prioritize the breakdown of fat and protein, while chimpanzees and bonobos, for example, have genomes fine-tuned for sugar-rich fruit. Evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker coined the term cognitive niche to mean that humans thrive not by adapting physically to narrow environments, but by adapting mentally to a wide range of them. Indeed, meat eating is a perfect example, whether it's scavenging leftovers, laying traps, or running down prey over miles. Humans have developed myriad ways to obtain nutrient-rich food, and in doing so, have ensured they can survive in all kinds of environments. Meat gave us the ability to think better, and thinking better allowed us to build societies, connections, and become even more strategic group hunters. But basic traps and hunting with spears was, of course, not the end of our hunting story. From around 500,000 years ago, we see signs of complex, hafted weaponry. Then, around 60,000 to 70,000 years ago, we see signs of the bow and arrow in Africa. This would transform human hunting again, allowing us to hunt at range, safely hidden away. Then, 10,000 to 20,000 years ago, humans began to domesticate animals, and dogs became our allies, helping us track our prey, and possibly bringing together ambush and persistence hunting into a slick operation of tracking animals until the moment was just right. And it was this, the domestication of animals, that would ultimately see the end to hunting as a necessity. We could farm meat, grow it from calf to cow. Hunting had made us good enough thinkers that we no longer needed it. And this would start us on a new path, one not of hunting, but of cities and agriculture. And so, the story of man the hunter is a patchwork of methods and strategies. It starts as we deviate from our primate cousins into becoming meat eaters, not fruit pickers. Over time, our drive to eat more calorie-dense flesh ensured that we developed new methods of obtaining it: scavenging, running, ambushing. But in nearing two centuries of study, what has always been clear is that humans are innovative survivors. Our methods may have changed, but our adaptability has always been a constant. You've been watching the entire history of humankind. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.